this week's sefer is Parashat Toldos. Parashat Toldos. Parashat Toldos, we're told, section 1, the birth of the twins. After a period of time that Rivka does not have children, the twins, Yaakov and Esau, are born. We're told about them. There's going to be a major section of the sefer between the birth of the twins and the sale of the birthright, until we get to what I would say most probably is the third section. I would divide the sefer into three: the birth of the twins, that's section one; section three, the blessings. Yitzchak wants to bless Esau, and it is Yaakov who takes the blessings because his mother sends him in there to get the blessings. And in the middle, between these two, we have a section that deals with Yitzchak, about the only parsha, the only section that really deals with Yitzchak. What was Yitzchak? What did he do? What were his great accomplishments? We know about Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu was the one who came out of Ur Kasdim, and he is the one who makes that dramatic change on the face of this earth, the one that we described over the last number of weeks as a change that revolutionized the whole world, and that a whole world feels it until today. But what was Yitzchak? And there are always all sorts of assessments of what was it that Yitzchak accomplished. Yaakov, on the other hand, of course, is going to have 12 tribes. He is going to become a mighty power. He is going to create the family that will be the Jewish people. But there's Yitzchak in the middle. Let's take a look at what the Torah has to say about Yitzchak. And as we looked at the parasha, it would seem, well, maybe for lack of a better word, Yitzchak was plain. Oh yeah, I like that's right. They also used the term passive about Yitzchak. Didn't do much. Good. I like to hear all of that because I will disagree with it. I was going to say violently, but lo la'alimut, no violence, but. Yitzchak sort of in Hebrew they would say who no failed bein hakisaot, he falls between the cracks, between the chairs. There's Avram on the one side and there's Yaakov on the other side, and there is Yitzchak, and I think that Yitzchak has not received great publicity at the hands of many people who dealt with Yitzchak. He's going to get very good publicity today. Yitzchak is not Novel Bein Hakisaot, but he is the colossus who connects Abraham with Yaakov. And watch. But what we have to understand is, how does this appear in Torah? What's Torah say about him? So here in the Sedra, chapter 26, if I'm not mistaken, let's say, I think chapter 26 is the chapter that deals with... That's right, chapter 26, one chapter that really deals with Yitzchak. And I'll read selections from chapter 26. Vayirov Vaaretz, I'm beginning with Pasuk 1. There was a famine in the land, in addition to the famine that had taken place in the days of Avram. And Yitzchak went to Avimelech, king of Plishtim, the king of the Philistines, to Gror. And God appeared to him there, because, as Rashi explains, it would seem that Yitzchak wants to follow in the footsteps of his father. What did his father do when there was a famine in the land? He went down to Egypt. So Yitzchak may very well be thinking of going down to Egypt. So God appears to him and he says, "Al teiret Mitzrayim, don't go down to Mitzrayim. You are the Ola Tamima. You are the Holy of Holies. You can't go down to Mitzrayim. Ein chutz l'aretz kedai lach. Chutz l'aretz is not the place for you. Shchon ba'aretz asher amar elecha. Live in the land that I will tell you." Two beautiful midrashim on the word shchon. One is aseh bo shchunah. Make a neighborhood. Build something in Eretz Yisrael.
You understand?
Make a marchaz someplace. Go on to the hills. Make a settlement. Shchon, make a shchuna. And then there's a second pshat in the Medrash, but I believe that the two of them are really one. The second pshat is Hashkein Shchina. Bring the divine presence down to Eretz Yisrael. You know how you bring the divine presence down to Eretz Yisrael? By building a shchuna. You build an Eretz Yisrael. That's what the Rebbe Shem wants. He wants Jews in Eretz Yisrael. Who about it as I was living this land, and I will be with you, and I will bless you, because to you and to your children I have given all of these lands. The promise that had been made, to Avraham, was now being repeated to Yitzchak. That Yitzchak is the one who's going to have all of these lands, and I will make your children many, kikokhli Hashem, I'm like the stars of the heavens, and I will give to your children all of these lands, at kol haratzot ha'el, all of these lands. And all of the people in the land are going to be blessed through you. And therefore, by Yeshiv Yitzchak, the Pasuk says, Pasuk 6, Yitzchak lived in Gror. And it seems there's a repeat of the same thing that Avraham went through twice. People start asking about his wife Rivka. She is very beautiful. He says that she is his sister because he was afraid that they would kill him. He spent a long time in Gror, and I like this pasuk. There's something, in a sense, very ugly that is being said over here. Vayashkef Avimelech, Melech Plishtim, Avimelech, King of Plishtim, looked ba'at hachalom through the window. Yitzchak is playing with his wife Rivka. In other words, he saw that their relationship was not the relationship of brother and sister. I certainly don't believe that Avimelech was a peeping Avimelech, and that Avimelech himself is there by the window looking in, you know, with his nose pressed against the window. Well, obviously what the pasuk means is that he sent his agents, you understand, the Shabak, he had his own Avishai Raviv, and they went and they checked, and they found that this is not a simple relationship. Okay. And he gets very upset, and he tells him, why did you tell us that she is your sister? She's really your wife. All right. Anyway, the story ends with Vayizra Yitzchak, Beretzahi, Pasuk 12, Yitzchak planted that year in that land. He got 100 times what he planted. That's what he got. And God blessed him. The man grew great. And he continued to get bigger and bigger. Until he became very big. One pasuk that describes the development, the evolution, the growth of Yitzchak as becoming one who is mighty and great. Now, it would seem that the description is a description of his financial wealth. He's becoming a monopoly. He's big. He had sheep and cattle, and his servants, and the Plishtim were envious of him. Now comes what I really want to concentrate on. The asher all of the wells that the servants of his father had dug during the days of his father, sitmum plishtim, the plishtim stopped up the wells. They closed them. Vayemalum afar, and they filled them with earth. Now, here we're talking about wanton damage, but more than that, we're talking, and we know it, we live in a part of the world where water is so terribly important. Every well is worth its weight in gold. If Plishtim up to the south, Plishtim most probably needed the water more than anybody else. So there are wells. So Avraham dug the wells. And the pasuk says that they stopped them up, they they close them up, and it seems just to make sure that it will be difficult should anybody ever want to dig up these wells again. By Yamal Afar, they fill them with earth. It seems they want these wells closed and shut. Why? It makes no sense. Vayomer Avinelech LeYitzchak, Avinelech said to Yitzchak, Lech me'imanu ki otzanto mimenu yod. Go away from us, because you have become, and there are two ways to read it, Lech me'imanu, go away from us, ki otzanto mimenu yod, you have become mightier than us, or ki otzanto mimenu yod, you have become mighty from us. From us. In other words, you're Jewish wealth is because you have in one way or another taken from us. Leich me'imanu ki otzamta mimenu miyod. Some years ago we said a shir, and this is really, that was based on the Nitziv, that this is the first real manifestation of anti-Semitism. Leich me'imanu ki otzamta mimenu miyod. Vayelech misham Yitzchak, so Yitzchak went. I mean, I can't imagine that Yitzchak's leaving Gror is like is a tefya leaving Anatevka. I mean, he wasn't. He mashali leaves with all of his great wealth and all of the servants that he has. Vayichan benachal Gror vayeshiv shom. He went to the river of the Wadi of Gror and he lived there. And here comes what seems to be the great accomplishment of Yitzchak. By Yashav Yitzchak, by Yachbor et Be'erot HaMayim, Asher Chofru Bimei Avraham Aviv. Yitzchak went, and he dug up the wells that Avraham Avinu had dug by the Satmum Plishtim, Acharei Mot Avraham. This is the important pasuk. Those wells that had been closed up by the Plishtim after the death of Avraham, Yitzchak is the one who now digs them up. Vayikra lehem shemot, and he gave them names, kashemot asher karo lehem aviv, the names that were given to it by his father. It seems that Yitzchak is the great digger of wells. I don't know, well, maybe the question that we have to ask today is would Avraham be proud, my son, the well digger, my son, the doctor, my son, the lawyer, Ashteyach, but my son, the well digger? That may be the question that we have to ask, because this is really what the Torah tells us about Yitzchak. He digs wells, and he gives the wells names. Vayachbur avde Yitzchak v'nachal, and the servants of Yitzchak dug in the wadi. Vayimtzu shom be'er mayim chayim, they found a new one, a well of living waters. The shepherds of Gror argued and contended with the shepherds of Yitzchak, saying, Lanu Hamayim, the water is ours. By the way, it's a bit of a hollow claim, the water is ours. You went ahead and you closed up wells that were giving living waters. And now Yitzchak digs a well, so you come to say, Lanu Hamayim. Vayikra Shem HaBe'er Esek. So Yitzchak called the name of the Be'er Esek, ki hit asku imo, because they contended with him. And said for all times, and this is pretty strange, I mean, is this the name that you give to a Be'er? I don't know, fight? Because we fought over it. I hope by the end of the shir we will have answered all of these questions. Vayachbru Be'er Acheret, they dug another. Well, Vayorivu Gamolah, and they argued about that second one too. Vayikroshmo Sitna. He now calls it Sitna. Sitna means hatred. This is already a stage after envy and jealousy. Now it's plain hatred. Vayatik Misham, he went from there. Vayachwa Be'er Acheret, and he dug another well. Velo Ravu Aleha. There no longer was any argument about it. Vayikroshmo Rechovot. And he called the name of that well Rechavot Vayom, and he said, Ki ato now, Hirchiv Hashem lanu, now God has made things wide and open for us, Ufarinu Baretz, and we're going to multiply and be fruitful in the land. So what do we know about Yitzchak? We know a great deal about Avram, and we're going to learn a great deal about Yaakov. What we really know about Yitzchak is he's a well digger. He may even be one who digs wells well, but he is a digger of wells. Now, I don't. What's so terribly exciting about the fact that he digs wells? Vayar Mishon, just another few psukim, he goes up from there, Beersheba, and God appeared to him in that night, and he told him in Beersheba, I'm the God of your father Avram, don't be afraid, I'm with you, I will bless you, I will multiply your children because of my servant Avraham, Avdi, my servant Avram. And he built a mizbeach, he built an altar. He is now doing exactly what Avram had done. Vayikra b'shem Hashem, he called in the name of God. Vayeid sham ahalo, and there he made his tent. Vayichu sham avde Yitzchak be'er. We thought that we're finished with the digging of the wells. He comes to Be'er Sheva. The servants of Yitzchak go out to dig a well. And then there's going to be a whole discussion. Avimelech comes and wants to make a peace treaty with him. And in middle of the negotiations, a final status between Avraham and Yitzchak, how exciting! Pasuk 32 in chapter 26 says, and it came to pass on that day, the servants of Yitzchak came, and they told him, you understand, in the middle of the meeting, Yitzchak, we have to tell you about the well that we dug. They said to him, we found water. He called the name of the place Shiva al Kain Shem Ha'ir Be'er Sheva al Hayom Hazeh. Okay. Right. That's the story of Yitzchak. Alright, we have a lot to do with the story of Yitzchak. The sheet that you have in front of you. On the first side of the sheet, and I don't believe we'll get beyond that, we'll see. First side of the sheet is a Ramban, and then there's a Ksava HaKabbalah. The Ramban. Vayikra Shem HaBe'er Esek, first one that they fought about, he called it Esek, says the Ramban, Yisaper HaKatuv V'yadir B'inyan HaBe'erot, the Torah tells us and speaks at length about the wells. Vein B'pshutei HaSipur Toeles V'lo Kovet Gadol Yitzchak. I think the Ramban here expresses what's bothering us. In the simple story, as it appears in the Torah, it doesn't seem that there's any great benefit to know about it. Well, what difference does it make to us today? I mean, what difference does it make? And what if I wouldn't have known that Yitzchak dug wells? Well, so what? What would it do to my Yiddishkeit? Would I be any less of a Jew? Oh, by the end of this year, oh my, would we be less of a Jew? But we're not there yet. But the Ramban says, the simple story doesn't seem to have any benefit. Low covered God of Yitzchak, it's not any great honor to Yitzchak. And say, he dug wells. Vahu va'aviv also otam v'shaveh, he and his father, in other words, he and his father did the same thing. So the Ramban takes the following approach, that there is something concealed over here, there's something hidden. The whole story of the wells comes to tell us that which is going to happen in the future. A well of living waters is metaphorically a symbol for a house of God that the children of Yitzchak are going to build. As it says, Mekor Mayim Chaim, the source of all living waters is God Himself. The Korah Harishon, the first one that they argued about, he called it Esek. Yirmos, that is something that hints and tells us that there's going to be a first Bet HaMikdash Bayit Rishon, Asher Tasku Imanu, that they argued with us, V'osu Otanu Kama Machlokot V'kama Milchamot Asher Herivu. The first Bet HaMikdash was destroyed because of an enemy that came from without. There were those who fought with us and contended with us and waged war with us until the Bet HaMikdash was destroyed. But the second Be'er, the second well, he called Sitna, hatred. Because you know what that's talking about? That's talking about the second Bet HaMikdash, where its destruction really came from within because of sinat chinam, hatred amongst Jews. V'hasheni koroshimo sitna. The second one was called Sitna Shem Koshem Min Havishan. That's a name that is more difficult, tougher than the first. V'hu Abayit Hashem, that's the second Beth HaMikdash. Shekora Uto Kishmo Shekatuvo. He used the words, those of us who learned Ezra and Nehemiah will remember this pasuk. U'b'malchut Achashverosh, during the kingdom of Achashverosh, b'tchilat malchuto, at the beginning of his kingdom, kafu sitna al yoshvei Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. They wrote the letters of hatred. The people living in the land did not want to permit Klal Yisrael to build Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash. They wrote sitna, hatred. V'chol yomav hayulanu l'sitna. All of the days of the second Beit HaMikdash, there was hatred from without, and really the Ramban is talking mainly about the hatred from without, because during most of that period we were a vassal state of other kingdoms. We were part of the Persian kingdom, we were part of the Greek kingdom. There was a period of independence in the middle, but then we became a vassal state of the Roman Empire. So there was constant sitna, hatred from without, until they destroyed the second Beit HaMikdash, terrible galus, the galus of the second Beit HaMikdash, very bad. Hashlishi, the third well, he called Rehovot, hu habayit ha'atid, that is the house that will be built in the future, sheyivoneh b'mehera v'yameinu, that will be built speedily in our days. That's going to be made without any kind of contention or struggle. God is the one who's going to extend our borders. God is going to extend your borders. That is in the future. With regard to the third Beit HaMikdash, the Navi uses the word Rechava, wide, open. And therefore the third Be'er represents the third Beit HaMikdash that is going to be built. Ufardinu Ba'aretz, we're going to multiply the land, Shekoha Amim Yavdu Shechem Echad, because it means that all people are going to serve God. Interestingly enough as well, Yitzchak invokes the name of God only by the third well. Vayatek Mishon, I'm reading Pasuk 22 in chapter 26, Vayatek Mishon, he moved from there, Vayachba Be'erachedet, he dug another well, V'lo Rovu Aleha, there was no argument about it, Vayikro Shema Rechovot, he called it Rechovot, Hayom, and he said, Ki Apa Hirchiv Hashem Lanu, now Hirchiv Hashem Lanu, God has widened us, Ufarinu Ba'aretz, so we're going to be fruitful in the land. He didn't use the name of God by the first or by the second, but by the third. Because Gemara brings a tradition that says that the third Beit HaMikdash is going to come down fully built, Min HaShemayim, the great Kablan of them all, HaKablan, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, is the one who's going to build the third Beit HaMikdash. One approach. There's no question about it. Medrash, many sources say that this is the meaning and the significance of the Be'erot. So that in a sense, just as the Ramban had said earlier in Pashat Lech Lecha, Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim, whatever the fathers did was a sign and indication of what the children are going to do. And as Avraham goes through the land, every place where he stops, he prays for his children who are ultimately going to be at those places. Yitzchak is doing more. Yitzchak is extending it now to the three Batei Mikdash, so that whatever he does, and it seems to us as though this is a very simple and mundane kind of activity, digging wells, he's not digging wells, he's building Jewish history. One approach. The Ksav HaKabbalah, and this is the approach that I want to focus on today. The Ksav HaKabbalah says, it's an amazing and a very beautiful Ksav HaKabbalah. He says the following: Vayikro lahem shemot, he calls them names, kashemot asher koro lahem aviv. When he dug up the wells that had been closed by the Plishtim. And that pasuk was a very important pasuk. I said that's a swing pasuk over here. Pasuk 18 in chapter 26. Vayoshav Yitzhak, Yitzhak went again by Yahweh at the Eirot HaMayim. He dug the wells of water, Asher Chofru Bimei Avram Ovim, that they had dug in the days of his father Avram, by Yisakmum Plishtim, and the Plishtim had closed them up. Which, by the way, is unnecessary because they'd already said a few psukim earlier that they had closed up the wells. And they, by Yisakmum Plishtim, when did the Plishtim close them up? Acharei Mot Avraham, after the death of Avram. Every part of this pasuk is fascinating. Vayikra lahem shemot, he called them names, kashemot asher karo lahem aviv, like the names that his father gave him. But what's so important about the names? If water is important, water is important. Wells are important, wells are important. What's so important about the names? So the Ksav HaKabbalah says the following, V'yitachim dekriyat shemot lebeirot hayav domeh l'shar kriyot shemot shahayu lezichron chazdei Hashem u'pu'ulotav. It's possible that the names that were given, were like the other names that were given by Avram and others. Every name represented something that commemorates some great kindness of God to remember a miracle that he had done. Kinyan, Vayikra Avram Shem Amokam Aru Hashem Yireh. Avram called Har Hamori Hashem Yireh. This is the place where God will be seen. Or Hashem Nisi, at the end of Parashat Bishamach, after the struggle against Amalek, Moshe builds an altar, and he calls the altar, God is my miracle. That means the name comes to commemorate a great event. Or Alkein Korola, LaBe'er Be'er Lachai Ro'i, the Be'er that Hagar was at, and then Yitzchak was at, the Be'er, the well at which I saw the living God, Kenos Avram. This is what Avram did, Ba'be'erot Asher Kafar, Shekarat Shmon B'Shem Hashem. He called the wells, he gave the wells names that represented or were a commemoration of the name of God. What Avram really wants to do is make God a household word by the whole world. So if you come to a Be'er that's Baruch Hashem, and a Be'er that's Emirat Hashem, and then you come to a Be'er that's called the Eibishter at Helfen, you understand? I'll meet you at the corner of the Eibishter at Helfen, and Baruch Hashem. You understand? You understand what a tremendous difference Avraham plans to make in the consciousness and the minds of people? Cain also Avram, this is what Avram did with the wells that he dug. He called them in the name of God. It was, that was his goal of Avram, was to teach the people the knowledge of God and to let them know there is nothing of any significance in idol worship. He came up with a great means. I mean, Avraham Avinu was not only the first great philosopher who graced the face of this earth, he was Madison Avenue par excellence. He was what they call in this country a yachtsan. His knowledge of yachasei tzibur, his ability to spread the great message. So he came up with Targulan Flaw, Hachnisa Yada, et Hamut'im al Tachat Kanfei Hashchina, in order to bring those who are in error beneath the wings of the Divine Presence. Kol Hashem HaBe'er B'Shem HaShem Yoreh al Amitut Mitziyot Hashem. He called a well by a name that would express the truth of the existence of God. What a beautiful, beautiful metaphor, he says. In this way, Avram was able to succeed in getting people to drink from his well. It has two meanings, not only to drink from the well, but to drink from the wellsprings of truth that are Avram. Ba'omram, as they would say, Neilchon Olish Ov Mayin Mi Be'er Hashem Kelolam. There was a well that was called the well of God, the eternal God. This awakened against their mistake. You know, all of a sudden, it suddenly strikes you, we're going to the well of the eternal God. And then people begin to think. Wells are needed by everybody. Since everybody needs a well, everybody needs water, they would all come to the wells, and the names of the wells became inscribed on their hearts and their minds. A great thing was done by Avram, the beloved one of God. He's a faithful servant. There are people who've run away from the king, and he wants to bring them back. He speaks to their heart. He tells them about how good the king is, until people are again ready to place their shoulders under the yoke of the great king. This is what Avram did in order to bring people who are idolaters to God. And while he was still alive, when Avram was still alive, he was the prince of God in their midst. As long as Avram was alive, they were afraid of him. And they wouldn't dare touch the wells or change the names of the wells. Nobody would have done that in his life. On the Machle Moto, after he died, they returned to their idolatry. In order, you know why they stop up the wells? Because they want to destroy the message of Avraham Avinu. Sure, they need water, but they would rather erase whatever it was that Avraham did. You know how you erase it? You close up the wells and you fill them with earth. And there's no Be'er anymore. If there's no Be'er anymore, there's no well. There's no Baruch Hashem well, in Yirtzeh Hashem well. What they want to do is, you know who they want to bury in these wells? Avram. And Avram's message. Yes, and they want to bury God in the well. Therefore, after the death of Avram, when Avram is no longer there, they begin the job of stopping up the wells. Lachen satmu ha-be'erot, that's why they close them. Ubi'batel ha-be'er, once there's no be'er, nit'batel shema, the name of the well is no longer there. So the pasuk tells us, you know what Yitzchak did? Yitzchak went and he opened the wells that Avram had dug. And he put all of his efforts in to renew, rejuvenate, and resuscitate the message of Avraham Avinu. Beautiful pshat of the Ksav HaKabbalah. Alright. My mother, Allah Shalom, would say, Kegin Vusat Mediz Gezuk, like, what's this all about? Where am I leading to? So I'll tell you where I'm leading to. I think it was a week and a half ago. It was a Thursday. About 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I get a call from Kol Yisrael. I didn't even know that there's an English program on Kol Yisrael. Get a call that there's going to be an interview with a professor by the name of Ze'ev Herzog. I will tell you right away what Ze'ev Herzog has to say. Ze'ev Herzog basically is going to say, and I'll read it, that archaeological findings show that the Torah is just. It's mythology, it's not true, it's the whole thing is, it's out, it's not even Buddha masses. There were no Buddhas, there were no masses, the whole thing is nothing. There was no Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, there was never an exodus from Egypt because Jews were never in Egypt. There was no miraculous conquest of the land. And this is at 5 o'clock, and it's only because the reporter says that Phil Chernowsky said, call Rabbi Gold. So I felt a tremendous responsibility, even though I was feeling a little down. So, all right, they plugged me in, they called me at 15:15, and I hear this Ev Herzog, and this it becomes in black before the eyes. And so, what I did in that interview was really I picked up on one sentence that he said. He said that for the secular community, and I wrote it down as he said it, the secular community that's strong and mature will have no difficulty with his revolutionary findings. His revolutionary archaeological findings that the whole Bible is all myth. So of course I said that I take umbrage, I take offense at something of this sort. In other words, 90% of the people in this country, if not 95%, sit down by the Seder every year and celebrate the exodus from Egypt. In other words, they are not strong and they're immature and they're not going to be able to handle this great discovery of Ze'ev Herzog. So I told them that 3,500 years of uninterrupted living history of the Jewish people is far more powerful and stronger than Ze'ev Herzog's great archaeological findings, and that in a few years from now his findings will be on the garbage heap of history and will still be sitting down to the Seder. All right. The moment I don't know how things work at first, but I hang up the phone and the phone rings. And it's Moshe. Kol hakavod, Rabbi. Now, so Moshe chatayim first, but then the fax machine started coming. My secretary sends me a fax, big letters, kol hakavod, same words. Okay, then of course there were a lot of fascinating calls during the course of the evening. I never knew that there was a program like that, and I never knew that anybody listens to the program. All of a sudden, I find out that all sorts of... I mean, I had the English news. I don't know about the English news. If I'm home and I have a chance, I watch Mabat, you understand? Chaim Yavin, you understand? Anyway, this is Thursday, because and the great article by Ze'ev Herzog is going to appear on Friday, the next day. It's already big news. Later in the evening, I get a call from Australian television that they'd like to do a show on me. So, when was it? I think it was Monday morning. I told them that I have to go into hospital on Tuesday. If you want to do the show, you better do it Monday morning. Monday morning, they came to the house, and they got a show. I tell you, though I wasn't feeling well, I was in good form that day. I was in good form. All right.
When
will you see it? I'm not going to see it. You know when you're going to see the show? Right now. You're going to get a living show right here. Because it all is extremely important, and you'll see how important it is in our understanding of Yitzchak Avinu and the whole Parsha. What is it that Professor Ze'ev Herzog had to say? I'll read only two paragraphs. His opening paragraph is the following. And I didn't even have to buy a Haaretz for this. You can get it off the internet in English, and my secretary did that for me. Yeah. This is what archaeologists have learned from their excavations in the land of Israel. The Israelites were never in Egypt, did not wander in the desert, did not conquer the land in a military campaign, and did not pass it on to the 12 tribes of Israel. Perhaps even harder to swallow is the fact that the united monarchy of David and Solomon, which is described by the Bible as original power, was at most a small tribal kingdom. And it will come as an unpleasant shock to many that the God of Israel, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, had a female consort, and that the early Israelite religion adopted monotheism only in the waning period of the monarchy, and not at Mount Sinai. Most of those who are engaged in scientific work in the interlocking spheres of the Bible, archaeology, and the history of the Jewish people, and who once went into the field looking for proof to corroborate the Bible story, now agree that the historic events relating to the stages of the Jewish people's emergence are radically different from what the story tells. And then he's going to tell us how his archaeological findings bring into the conclusion that everything that we have and everything that we believe in is all just never happened. All the Eibishter of you. Alright. His last paragraph over here. And this is terribly important to you. Yeah. The archaeology of the land of Israel is completing a process that amounts to a scientific revolution in its field. Oh, he keeps talking about his findings. These are findings of such great import, so new, so radical, so different, so revolutionary, I mean, this is more than Columbus discovering America. This is the evidence of telling us that a living Torah just ain't. It ain't. All right? The archaeology of the land of Israel is completing a process that amounts to a scientific revolution in its field. It is ready to confront the findings of biblical scholarship and of ancient history. But at the same time, you know what he's very upset about? But at the same time, we are witnessing a fascinating phenomenon in which all this is simply ignored by the Israeli public. The Israeli public just isn't taking Zev Herzog and all of his scientists too seriously. Many of the findings mentioned here have been known for decades. The professional literature in the spheres of archaeology, Bible, and the history of the Jewish people has addressed them in dozens of books and hundreds of articles. Nevertheless, these revolutionary views are not penetrating the public consciousness. God bless the public consciousness. About a year ago, my colleague, the historian Professor Nadav Ne'eman, published an article in the Culture and Literature section of Haaretz entitled, "To Remove the Bible from the Jewish Bookshelf," quote unquote. To remove the Bible. But there was no public outcry. Nobody paid attention. Any attempt to question the reliability of the biblical descriptions is perceived as an attempt to undermine our historic right to the land. Ah, you see, politics has already reared its ugly head. Now, when I read politics into Torah, that's Torah. But when he starts reading politics into archaeology, that's politics ugly. Now, one of the benefits of undoing all of Jewish history as we know it in the Bible is that we have absolutely no claim to land. There was no David, there was no Commonwealth, there was no Shlomo, there were no 12 tribes. We weren't a slave people that came in. There was no miraculous entry. It's all garnished with garnished. And in Cain, if so, then their claim is maybe better than our claim. But he says it's because of this that nobody wants to listen to what he and his scholars have to say. And as shattering the myth of the nation that is renewing the ancient kingdom of Israel. We see ourselves as the third commonwealth. We are renewing what was interrupted 2,000 years ago. It wasn't so. It turns out that part of Israeli society is ready to recognize the injustice that was done to the Arab inhabitants of the land. Now we're coming down to the last paragraph. There are some that are strong and sure enough to see, recognize the injustice, and is willing to accept the principle of equal rights for women. You know, I don't know what women have to do with archaeology. Now, there may be women archaeologists, but I think he just throws this in over here, so he thinks that he now has 50% of the people on his side, because he said something nice about the women, that they deserve equal rights. But the people are not up to adopting the archaeological facts that shatter the biblical myth. Remember the word shatter. The blow to the mythical foundations of the Israeli identity is apparently too threatening, and it is more convenient to turn a blind eye. What are we going to do?
Doesn't he also attack Christianity?
Well, I'm a rabbi. Oh. And my job is to defend the faith. I'm not interested, let the Christians worry about themselves. That's their business. They never worried about us. I'm not going to worry about them. I'm only going to deal with the... So first of all, this past Friday, I knew I'd be home dead for a few days. I'll have time to read. So I did ask my wife to buy me this weekend Haaretz. I haven't bought the Haaretz in 10 years. Finally got the Haaretz. So of course there was a tremendous amount of response to the article of Zev Herzog. Many of the responses I have here, many of the responses are very fascinating. Take it easy, Zev Herzog, even by non-religious scientists. All of his archaeological findings are based on the fact that there are certain datings for each level in the earth. Every level in the earth represents, I don't know, 500 years, 700 years. And therefore, when you dig down to a certain level, you should be at a certain year. And if when you dig down to that level, and you don't find pots and pans from such and such dynasty that should have been there, Yitzhak and Aliyah, it never existed. In other words, you go down a few levels to what should have been the time of David and Shlomo. I don't know. You don't find much there except, I don't know, a discarded Aden bottle and a few other things down 2,500 years down there. So, of course, one of the a number of the people who write say, wait a minute, what happens if all of your dating is incorrect? And what happens if each level would represent another 200 years? I mean, you're so certain that every level equals such number of years. And therefore, when you got down to bedrock, that should have been the time of David. And there was nothing there. There was nothing there. So there are many who say that with new scientific discoveries, they're ready to shatter the myths of Zev Herzog and all the rest of them, because all the dating was wrong. Right. That's not the approach that I took with Australian television. I don't have to become an amateur scientist and an archaeologist. But I did make the following statement, and this is true on many levels. Scientific knowledge, assuming that it's scientific, and by the way, archaeology is not necessarily the great science that it may seem. Science is never absolute. Science has never reached the end of the world. Today, in my laboratory, such and such is true. But science is always open to change and evolution. We know more now 50 years ago than we knew. We know more now than 50 years ago. We know more now than we knew 1,000 years ago. Who knows what we're going to discover tomorrow? The truths of religion are eternal. Science is forever evolving, forever changing. You can't bank your life on science. That's one terribly important approach. Aside from the fact that I say that all the methods that are being used by archaeologists may very well be are wrong. There's no question about it that they're wrong. We said a shiur a few weeks ago where we quoted the Kuzri, where the Kuzri describes the veracity and the truthfulness of Torah because we are an uninterrupted chain of historic evidence, father to son, father to son. There's never been any break in Jewish identity. We learned that sentence in the Kuzri where the Kuzri says, do I need proof that there was Alexander the Great? I don't need proof that there was Alexander the Great. I know that there was an Alexander the Great. Because Alexander the Great happened, and because he happened, that's history. We have history on our side. The fact is, what Zev Herzog is attacking, he's attacking a guy by the name of Professor William Foxwell Albright. And for Australian television, I read quotes from Albright. Albright was the great archaeologist of the he was from Johns Hopkins University for 30 years. He and afterwards his Talmidim, I think he died in the 60s or early 70s. He clearly says that he set out to prove that the Bible is correct, and that everything, here it is, the archaeology of Palestine. There was no Israel at the time he wrote the book. So he writes about the archaeology of Palestine. I'll just he talks about those who rejected the truthfulness of the Bible. So he says these premature ideas were accepted by many writers and found their way into widely used handbooks. Now they have been abandoned by virtually all students of literature. since they cannot be squared with our rapidly increasing knowledge of the grammar and vocabulary of the Canaanite dialect. He says, all the old Torahs are out, yet it will be a long time before the last traces of such deviations are eliminated from modern handbooks dealing with biblical history. It will take a long time before they're going to say, yeah, we were wrong, we were wrong. No, they can't do that. And he can't do it, Zev Herzog can't do it either. Biblical historical data are accurate to an extent far surpassing the ideas of any modern critical students who have consistently tended to err on the side of hypercriticism. He accuses all of those who find the Bible as being incorrect or mythology as hypercritics who went out there with one purpose, to bury the Bible. That's what they wanted to do. They weren't digging up the Bible. They were not digging up the tells. They wanted to make a tell of Torah. That's what they wanted to do. This is the position that's taken by Albright, and he even deals with the great. When I say great, okay, I mean with a little G. The great Bible critics of the last century, Wellhausen, was Julian Wellhausen, who was the sort of supposed to be the father of biblical criticism. The Torah wasn't written by God. It was put together from Shtiklach. And this is going to be important right away. In other words, so what is this Torah that we have, according to them? The Torah that we have was written at some much later date, possibly at the time the Jews came back from Babylon, or maybe during the period of the kingdom. They put together all of these folk myths about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Egypt. But it never happened. All mythology, it never happened. Albright says, thanks to archaeological determination of the site of most biblical places, it is also possible to establish the age and historical significance of many lists of towns in the Bible. Wellhausen had said that the lists of cities that appear in different places in Tanakh, there are no such places. There were no such places. It's all myth. So along comes Professor Albright, and he starts digging. But he's digging for the truth. And in digging for the truth, he begins to find site after site with inscriptions. And he says, therefore, a good case in point is the list of the Levitic cities in Joshua and in Chronicles, which Wellhausen, followed by most subsequent critics, considered an artificial product of some post-exilic scribe's imagination. The whole list of cities is made up. Careful examination of this list in the light of all known archaeological facts makes it quite certain that the list is much more ancient, and that the only time when all towns mentioned in it were in Israelite possession was under David and Solomon. He says those lists of cities in Tanakh that you're finding, Yeshua, that Wellhausen said never existed, were no more than a figment of imagination. He found them all! Most of the archaeological digs of this century in this country were done by Albright and his company. But I want to take you one further step. And this is probably the most beautiful one of all. You remember the Hertz Chumash? Well, I think we were all raised in our synagogues, we were raised on the Hertz Chumash. Now, if you don't have art scroll, that's okay. But there were some very good things about the Hertz Chumash. And there were those people, when they didn't want to listen to Kriya Satoru, would read at the end of each Chumash, he has essays. I just want to read one section of one essay. It's at the end of Bereshis. I would imagine if I'd be in shul now, I would, in the Hertz Chumash, on page 395. By the way, the first edition of the Hertz Chumash was published in 1936. He was chief rabbi of England. Listen to this. It's entitled, small section, The Inconvenience of Biblical Tradition. Inconvenience, very important word. And he has, it's a quotation marks. That's right. the inconvenience of biblical tradition. First paragraph, watch. Little need be said in regard to the extreme and baseless skepticism recently revived in Soviet anti-religious circles that the Israelites never were in Egypt. Zev Herzog comes last week to tell us of his great shattering discovery that the Israelites were never in Egypt. In 1936, Hertz is talking about the Soviets, who were the worst atheists of all. In 36, it was already old hat that the Soviets had said that the Israelites were never in Egypt, and that in consequence there could never have been either an oppression or an exodus. So Herzog wants to tell each one of us that he has made this great shattering revolutionary discovery. The Israelites were never in Egypt. So you should know, he's not a new scientist. He's an alter apokoidus. That's what he is. A communist from the, from Stalin's Zeit. And Hertz is responding to that. This is so beautiful. You just have to learn this. It's really good. There is one conclusive answer to the doubts as to the historicity, I think that's the way you say it, the historicity of the Exodus and other crucial events in scriptural history, one conclusive proof, and that is what has aptly been called the inconvenience of biblical tradition. It's inconvenient, meaning the following. One or two examples will both explain this argument and make clear its unanswerable force. The first example is taken from the story of Abraham. For centuries, the Hebrew tribes waged a life and death struggle with the native population for the possession of ancient Palestine. Now, this is 36 he's writing this, long before there's an establishment of a state of Israel. He says, during the days of David, Solomon, for 800 years, Jews are in Eretz Israel, and they are fighting to wrest the country from the people living here. If this whole biblical story is myth, do you know what would have been the greatest myth of all? If they would have written a myth saying, we were born here. But you know what Torah insists from the very beginning? We came from Ur Kasdim. Why in heaven's name would Jews have said at a time that they're dragging to stake their claim, they're going to go write a myth, Dunstan? If you're going to write a sheker, at least write an intelligent sheker. For centuries, the Hebrew tribes waged a life and death struggle with the native population for the possession of ancient Palestine. But instead of the Hebrews claiming that they too are natives of Canaan, or that they were the true aborigines of its soil, Bible tradition concerning the beginnings of the Hebrew people is emphatic that its ancestors were not born in Canaan, but were nomads, immigrant shepherds, and had their origin in Ur of the Chaldees. That's all. If we're talking about myth, Zanish Canaan, if you write a sheker, it's got to be a good one. That's one. Now, even the skeptical historian is forced to admit that such a tradition must be based on what could such a tradition that we came from Ur Kasdim, on what can it be based? The most skeptical scientist of all must admit it can be based on only one thing. There can only be one reason why Torah keeps saying it time and time again that we came from Ur Kasdim. Because it's the truth. Now, even the skeptical historian is forced to admit that such a tradition must be based on strict history, as no people would invent such an inconvenient tradition. In regard to a matter of vital importance, like its right and title to its national homeland. To take another example. The record over here is, in this set we have the Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But mainly Yitzchak and Yaakov. Well, who do they marry? Who do they marry? They marry women from Aram Nahadai. According to the dating of all archaeologists, this myth was written during the period, the middle period of the first temple. I don't know, the Bronze Age or the Plastic and Teflon Age. I don't know which age it was. But in one of those ages, so you know what that adds up to? It's a myth, right? It's supposed to be a myth that they married Rivka and the wives of Yaakov. And who did they take them from? Aram. Anybody who has even the slightest knowledge of Tanakh knows that the worst, most brutal enemy that we had during the period of Bayit Rishon was Aram. The Nevi'im described how they tore open the bellies of pregnant women to kill Jewish children. What an inconvenient tradition to say that where did Yitzchak and Yaakov, the great others, you know who they married? Nazi shiksas. What an inconvenient tradition. Can you imagine saying, go make this up, if you can make up a lie, say that they married a chveise, a bisyankiv medel that they found in Eretz Yisrael? Why make up a tradition that flies in the face of all intelligence? It's such an inconvenient tradition. The only reason why they wrote it is because it must be so. The third example is great. All this applies with immeasurably greater force in regard to the historicity of the oppression in Egypt. Zev Herzog, like the old Soviets, is shattering no discovery that there was no oppression in Egypt. Compared with the Egyptian bondage and the deliverance therefrom, everything else in Bible history is of secondary importance. Zefer Yetziat Mitzrayim is the most important event in all of Bible history. There most probably are dozens of mitzvahs, if not more, that are based on one thing. Every Shabbos and every Yom Tov, 3,500 years later, we talk about Zefer Yetziat Mitzrayim. Every day there's a mitzvah to remember Yetziat Mitzrayim, the exodus of Egypt, in the morning and in the evening. The memory of that bondage and deliverance is woven into the message of legislator, historian, psalmist, prophet, and priest, and a large portion of Jewish life, both in the biblical and the post-biblical ages. Everything is but a zecher liyitziat Mitzrayim, an echo and reminder of that divine event which meant the birth of Israel as a nation. Now, it is unthinkable that any nation, unless forced to do so by the overwhelming compulsion of unforgettable fact, would of its own account have wantonly affixed to its forefathers the stain and dishonor of slavery in a foreign country. Can you imagine making a phony history, and I say, you know what? You know what my Zayda was? My Zayda was a ferds ganef in Galicia. A horse thief in Galicia, you understand? Would I create a myth of that sort? You know what kind of myth I would create? Maybe not a myth. My Zayda is again a good deed in Galicia. Okay? No people, listen to this one sentence, no people has ever yet invented a disgraceful past for itself. The invention by a later age of a story so humiliating to national self-respect would be still more astounding in the case of Israel when we consider, do you know what Egypt is in the days that the myth is supposed to have been written by the authors of the Bible, according to Herzog and the historians, at a period of time that Egypt was a banana republic? Egypt was nothing. So can you imagine creating a disgraceful past? Or that we were slaves to these fashlugan Egyptians? It makes no sense. If therefore Israel's sojourn and bondage in Egypt were merely a fiction, such fiction would be quite inexplicable. In fact, it would be a psychological miracle. Even a radical student of this question, like a Professor Pete, who was also one of these Rishonim, says the following: that Israel was in Egypt under one form or another, no historian could possibly doubt. A legend of such tenacity representing the early fortunes of a people under so unfavorable an aspect could not have arisen save as a reflection of real occurrences. Number one, Zev Herzog has tried to tell the country over here that he's come up with some new revolutionary shattering evidence. We were never in Egypt. It's not new. It's not shattering. Sigourish Nagurish. He's surprised why Jews don't accept it. You know why? I said this on Australian TV. We have survived greater threats to Judaism and the Bible than Zev Herzog. Mohammed say Ibigalet, Mivel Ibigaletin, Zev Herzog as well. They've been much greater threats. So here, Hertz brings the idea of the inconvenience of tradition. If we are to accept for a moment that it's myth, it's the most ridiculous and nonsensical myth of them all. Few more minutes. The Chov. How I found this, I don't know, it was here in the back of my head, of salivation. This week's Sedra, it says that Ela Tolos Yitzchak, these are generations of Yitzchak. Avram, hold it as Yitzchak. Rashi brings the strange statement. What do you mean, Avram? Hold it as Yitzchak. Avram gave birth to Yitzchak. So he says the following. Lefi shahoyu leitzoni hador omrin. The jokers, the comics of the generation said, Me Avimelech nisabro Sora. Avimelech, Sora had been taken to the house of Avimelech. She became pregnant from him. She'd been living all of those years with Avram and didn't become pregnant. After she was in the house of Avram, she becomes pregnant. Me Avimelech nisabro Sora. I mean, of course, they meant it as a joke, but of course, it's a joke that is ugly and wicked. So therefore, Avram, holding his Yitzchak, the pasuk says that Yitzchak was the spitting image of Avram. You looked at Yitzchak and you saw Avram. In order that those jokers, should not be able to joke anymore. The love goes on to say, Yitzchak was always a joke. His name was Yitzchak. He was a joke. Even Sarah says, Milel Avram, did his people are going to live. Kol HaShomea, whoever is going to hear about this birth, Yitzchakli is going to live. Of course, some of the Mephoroshim say that Yitzchakli is going to be full of happiness. But the word Yitzchak means Psitakalechta. There's a galachta. There were those even who said that, you know, Yitzchak was a foundling child that they brought into the house. And they're playing the game out there and they're telling us that this Yitzchak is the son of Avram. Therefore, God made Yitzchak to look precisely like Avram. And for many years, you know what Yitzchak was? Yitzchak was a joke. They left at Yitzchak. More than that, they must probably paid no attention to him at all. And then the Rav says, a strange thing happened. This Yitzchak starts digging wells. Well, which wells is he digging? The wells of his father Avram. And you know what he's doing? He's giving them the same names that his father gave them. Oh, wait a minute. All of a sudden, a bit of a shudder goes through society. Because you know what they had thought? They had really thought that with the death of Avram, you know what dies with him? His message dies with him. And not only that, we can bury not only Avram, we can bury everything he stands for. We're going to stop up his wells. The names will never be mentioned again. There will not be the Be'er of Amirtz Hashem or the Be'er of Baruch Hashem. They thought that Avram has been consigned, I don't know, I imagine to an artifact of archaeology. But Zev Herzog doesn't even say that Avram is a shtick archaeology. Goodness, Avram's gone. But then all of a sudden, and as the Rav says, they begin to rub their eyes to see, they see straight this Yitzchak who's been the big joke, the one whom they've laughed at all of these years. He's digging wells, and he's digging them with a passion. and he's giving the same names that Avram gave. And do you know what Yitzchak is doing? Yitzchak is becoming the image of Avram. What Avram did in his lifetime, Yitzchak is now continuing. So therefore they begin to contend with him. The first bear is called Esek, Hidaskuimo. They thought, you know, we'll fight it out with him a little bit, and we'll put this Yitzchak in his place. So all right, then we can rest easily again. We've taken care of Avram, we'll take care of Yitzchak. Oh, no, but Yitzchak keeps going. He keeps digging wells. Yitzchak keeps digging wells, the wells of Avram, and he gives those wells of Avram the names that Avram gave. And all of a sudden, do you know what people begin to realize? Avram is alive and well. He's a power to contend with. And do you know who represents that power? That's Yitzchak. And do you know the proof that Yitzchak is powerful? They hate him. The second Be'er is called Sitna. If they hate you, you're alive. If they despise you, you're alive and well. All of a sudden, the wells take on a completely different meaning. Yitzchak digging the wells of Avram, and certainly according to the Ksav HaKabbalah, as we explained it, Yitzchak now presents an image to the world that's really shattering. You know what's shattering? That Avram has a future. And we haven't gotten rid of Avram. We cannot bury Avram. Avram is going to keep popping up again throughout all of history. That's the importance of the wells. Yitzchak becomes the mighty and powerful one. Yitzchak is not passive. We're talking about Yitzchak passive. Yitzchak is powerful. He shatters all the ideas of the people of his generation. He's not the joke anymore. He's the one to contend with. He's the one to be frightened of. He's the one to hate. And ultimately, he's going to be the one that you're going to have to make a covenant with him. The wells, just some simple story. Not a simple story at all. Not a simple story at all. There are those who dig in order to attempt to shatter Torah. There are those who dig in order to bring proof against Torah. And then there are the Yitzchaks and his children, Ad Hayom Hazeh, who dig in order to show that Torah is alive. I would say, if I'm to sum up this year, all's well that ends well, and he who laughs best.